Good morning, Austin. This is your host, Wes Dotson. You are listening to Declarations from Independence here on KVRX. It is 5:56 a.m. in Austin, Texas on Tuesday, August 27th. I have in the studio with me, Ryan Jaffe and Matthew Cox. Ryan, you're with the Senate College of Councils, is that correct?
Yes, I'm a co-chair of the Senate of College Councils. So a Senate of College Councils is a really, really cool organization where we try to focus on the academic policies around the university. So when you have the two different LSOs, you have student government and you have Senate of College Councils. Student government commonly deals with student life, while Senate of College Councils deals with the academic policy surrounding everything from professors to undergraduate research to basically anything you would like to know from the syllabus, from those little blurbs that they read about specific policies, disability policies, attendance, and stuff like that.
Alrighty, and Matthew, you are with the Eyes of Texas. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that organization, what you all do?
All right, actually, there's been a bit of a name change. It's gone from Eyes of Texas because that was, you know, a visual pun. Now it's right. Longhorns for Voting Reform.
That's a bit more descriptive of I think what y'all do there.
Yeah, not so jokey, but it's basically what we're trying to do is we're trying to improve election statuses. It's not partisan at all. Literally, we do not talk about politics besides, you know, how elections work, how voting systems work, things like campaign finance laws, and we work to try to get those things improved. Not just on a school level, which we already have with the amendment we passed through the school government last year, putting in a thing called single choice variable vote, but also trying to work with both the city and the state to see if we can get things improved.
Yeah, no, I remember talking about that in my organization, the Texas Orator, which we got started up last November of 2017. We were discussing that, and I think that turned out pretty well in terms of the last election. I know it was not actually implemented at that time. Anurag, oh my. So we have a special treat for you. We have Anurag Singh, the host of another show here on Not Fake News. Let me get you mic'd up here, Anurag. Make sure you're coming through.
Hello, hello, testing.
Yeah, you seem to be coming through just fine. So you are walking with a bit of a peg leg. Can you tell us that story, Anurag? For folks here at the show, Anurag's got a cast on or a boot. What's the story there?
Well, the official story is it is a skiing accident and I was saving a puppy, but unofficial story is that I was running, someone was shooting at me with a Nerf gun, actually.
It escalates.
And I ran up a hill and I fell down the hill and tumbled all the way down like Jack or something like that.
Okay, well, there we go. We've got our wounded warrior here in the studio. Anurag is a member of the Texas Order as well. We all are, in fact. And so we have your show at Thursday 5 p.m. Is that your slot?
Yep, Thursday 5 p.m., Fake News.
So listeners can tune in to Not Fake News at Thursday on 5 p.m. to hear all of the stories du jour with Anurag, myself, and a couple of others. But I wanted to let you know that you are listening to KVRX on 97.1 FM, and that you can go to buytsm.com to find all of the Texas Student Media merchandise, as well as local live albums. You can support Texas students in their pursuit of Texas media, I suppose, is the best way of saying that. That supports KVRX, that supports the Daily Texan, that supports all of the students doing wonderful things here at UT. So we're going to get right into it. We've got the news of the past week. I have not been with y'all for about 3 weeks, and it has been quite an explosive news cycle. I think the biggest thing that we can all agree on for UT students is the new chancellor, J.B. Milliken, being selected. I think that has the most proximate effect, and we talked about that last time I was with y'all on air, but I want to get the kind of takes of the room. I know a lot of y'all have been looking into that. Matthew, you've got strong opinions about McRaven. How are you feeling about Milliken coming in?
Well, Milliken looks good. I mean, the City University of New York, which is where he comes from.
Right.
I mean, he was chancellor there for, I think, 4 years, and, you know, it's been doing good. It's very quickly become one of the best colleges in the nation, and, you know, it would be great to see if we can see the kind of explosive growth rate they've had with underneath Milliken.
Yeah, and I think Milliken definitely focused there on using CUNY, which is that City University of New York, as a tool for economic development in terms of getting students from disadvantaged neighborhoods in New York specifically into the middle class or even the upper middle class. That was something that he really focused on and something that I think he's going to bring to UT. Anurag, I want to get your thoughts here because I know that we've talked about the UT administration ad nauseum, but I want to pull your opinion on Milliken as a chancellor.
Well, I'm not really familiar with Milliken's background other than the fact that he was a chancellor at CUNY, but obviously I had plenty of issues with McRaven, which I made very clear.
Right.
I think that he wasn't very frugal with the money, and he spent money on a lot of projects that never actually materialized into anything. And rather than helping students, a lot of that money that he spent could have been used to help students. And if education is ostensibly used to get people out of the cycle of poverty, then obviously Milliken's work at CUNY, helping people of disadvantaged communities, getting them into college, I think that's a good thing, obviously. But of course, we have to see what happens, because in his statement, he said that I'm looking forward to the future of the country. Or something like, he said something about like the future of the country,
right,
and the future of education, which seems very, shooting for the moon. But I think that chancellors need to be a bit more realistic and realize that their job isn't, president of the United States. It's to just run a university system.
Yeah, they're a CEO, really, of the school system.
Yeah.
They're responsible for enacting money policy and making sure like funds are attributed well and that they're going to students, unlike McRaven. So if he has a past track record of prioritizing disadvantaged students, then at least we can be hopeful that he'll do at least a part of the same here.
Right. And he definitely focused on part of that mission. He focused on graduation as the end goal of the university. I think he really focused on making sure students were taking the requisite hours per semester to really get on that four-year track, not spending extra time at the university and losing out on wages, but also not, taking a crazy amount of course load and burning out. So I think that's something we can hope to see at UT and the UT system as he addresses some of the issues that UT has been facing with that. But we're going to get into the national news of the week. I think the biggest story in the past 3 weeks is the Cohen plea deal. So we're going to pull the room on that. But first, we'll just outline the facts. Cohen on Tuesday, August 21st, walked into a courtroom in Manhattan and pled guilty to 8 charges. The first 5 counts that he pled guilty to were tax evasions that I don't think are particularly pertinent to the national story, but the last 3 counts are really where the meat is. We've got one count of making a false statement to a financial institution, one count of willfully causing an unlawful corporate contribution from June 2016 to October 2016, and one count of making an excessive campaign contribution on October 27th, 2016. And this is all according to some fantastic reporting by Vox. So to get into a little bit, that false disclosure count is essentially Cohen applying for a home equity line to get funding for that $130,000 that shows up in that excessive contribution to a campaign that he used to pay off Stormy Daniels as Trump's former paramour, or alleged paramour, I suppose. And then the unlawful contribution on from June 2016 to October 2016 relates to a payment that Cohen made to American Media Inc., formerly known as, which owns the National Enquirer, to pay the other individual that is potentially a Trump paramour, McDougal. And so we saw in the actual plea deal that Cohen named or mentioned the president and essentially said that he had directed Cohen explicitly to make these payments, making him, in the words of Duke's Lisa Kern Griffin, the law professor there, all but an unindicted co-conspirator. So I want to get the opinions of the room, and Ryan, we'll go to you first on this. What are your thoughts going into the story, and how do you think it's really going to play out in the national scene?
Yeah, definitely right when you look at it, you kind of think this is Trump's web of criminality. So you're seeing people dropping like flies around him. And just the fact that you see Cohen just finally throw in the towel and plead guilty like nothing. He just goes in, slams, puts all the cards on the table,
right,
and says all this stuff is going on, and it's all related to Trump. And so I definitely would have to agree with her statement that it's come, like, the cards are coming into him. Like, everything's closing around him. Whether or not he's able to jump out and escape from this type of encroaching impeachment case, we really don't know. Just because of the partisan nature of all this,
right.
Regardless, due to public opinion, it's definitely looking like he is guilty of some sort of crime.
Yeah, Ryan, it seems that you're coming down on the fact that this is really an important story for Trump. But I know, Anurag, we've been talking in the Slack chat for the order that this might really just be noise at the margins in terms of Trump's, the potential for Trump to be impeached and mm-hmm. also public opinion. So if you want to kind of walk us through that line of argument.
Well, I mean, of course, my first reaction to the story is that there is no honor among thieves, and Michael Cohen immediately flipping on Trump and basically spilling the beans about the whole situation kind of demonstrates that. But, you know, I think that just before I get into why I don't think this is actually as serious as people might believe, you know, Donald Trump said that he hires the best people and he has the best, you know, the greatest people, and yet that they, and yet, you know, to be able to violate campaign finance law, which is well known to be very simple to not violate.
Right.
If Michael Cohen had just been a better lawyer, they would be able to have, you know, made this transaction. If Trump had paid with his own money, actually there would be, because of there was a lift on campaign contributions by the individual candidate.
You can contribute as much as you want to your own campaign.
And that's thanks to Buckley v. Valeo. So Trump could have done that and avoided this whole felony. Now, it's still an open question as to whether a president can be indicted. And so this whole, it should be understood that Mueller is not someone that, his job is to try to find, to just present some evidence to Congress, right? And the Congress has to go and do whatever they want with it. And so I don't think that the Congress we have right now will even begin impeachment. And, you know, it's an open question as well whether the Democrats will get the House. I don't think they will get the House. Actually, I'm very skeptical that they will. I know that they're probably not going to get the Senate, and I'm very skeptical that they'll get the House. And even if they get the House, is it even wise to begin impeachment processes? I think that impeachment is a very political process, and they'll have to spend a lot of political capital on that, and then they'll end up with Mike Pence. So right. I don't know if that's really something that we should even consider.
Yeah, Matthew, I want to get your response to that. I'm not entirely sure where you fall on this, but if you want to give your thoughts.
Well, I don't really know where it's going to end up as we go along here.
Okay, well, there we go. Same hot take from Matthew.
Well, sorry, my apologies for that being short. It's just, you know, we are coming across the question on whether or not, you know, which of these possible crimes is the crime that might actually end up, you know, falling him down.
Right.
I mean, it started off with the initial special investigation was about whether or not there was collusion with Russia. But now we're even going into whether or not there's just random, payment contribution campaigns, which is kind of what happened to Clinton, obviously. But it didn't start with Lewinsky. It started with the Whitewater campaign.
Yeah, I mean, the cover-up is always worse than the actual crime when it comes to impeachment, as we've seen with both Nixon and Clinton being really got for lying under oath. But I think we want to get back to the idea of affecting Donald Trump as the standard by which we judge these stories. And I kind of have a threefold test for that. So first is it going to affect public opinion within the Republican base or within the Republican Party at large? And we're already seeing that this story has not really moved the needle on his approval ratings. We saw it tick down about 1% according to the 538 approval tracker poll. But again, that's within the margin for statistical noise in terms of this story not really being the prime mover there. And then the second, is it going to affect the way that Republican lawmakers in both the Senate and the House treat President Trump and react to it? We're already seeing that Paul Ryan is just making kind of bloviations about, well, I can't assess the truth because I'm not involved in the investigation directly. And so we're not seeing any substantial change there in the way that they are talking about this with regards to impeachment. And then finally, if the Democrats do take back the House, does it move the needle on the likelihood that Trump is going to be impeached? I don't think that we see any substantial reason to believe that it would. We're already in the situation where most, I would say, Democrats think that impeachment is going to be something to look at already. So if this is, you know, I think to the extent that this changes the calculation there, it might just be the facially stated reason why they impeached Donald Trump or President Trump currently, and it's not going to change the probability matrix for that. I think it's really just going to be the headline reason, but Alrog's exactly right to point out the question of whether or not a sitting president can be indicted. I think that's a question that the Justice Department currently it leans more towards that the president can't be indicted. At least the current Justice.
Well, I mean, that's based on this, like, old memo. It's not a real policy, right, from what I recall.
And, I mean, and the way that you're going to want to look at that in terms of how it's going to change is if we see any substantial shift in that, it's going to be as a review of that memo, and that really is a process that takes quite some time. The Justice Department is a slow-moving entity, and so I really don't think we're going to, you know, change that much. But we want to remember that back in May, Trump actually admitted on Twitter that he reimbursed Cohen for the $130,000 payment to Daniels. So we do have, you know, whatever the noise is on TV from either Giuliani or Trump himself, we have that statement in tweeting available to us. So we want to really, you know, keep our eyes on the ball there and make sure we're not allowing ourselves to kind of get pushed around by the news cycle there.
I mean, Trump could have been impeached theoretically on day one, right?
Yeah,
the emoluments clause,
right,
was something that the Democrats could have used. So I don't, like you said, I mean, I think if they were going to impeach, which even, you know, they asked Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer about the process of impeachment, and they're still iffy on that. So, you know, you would think that, you know, if a Democratic president had done this, all the Republicans would be talking impeachment.
Of course.
And, you know my thoughts on the Democrats and how spineless they are. They still won't talk about impeachment. They don't have a political strategy, like a proper political strategy. And so, you know, there's a lot of, when you said that most Democrats are looking for impeachment, I don't believe that's true. I think, right, a lot of them are still undecided about what they're going to do about this.
Yeah,
and because I don't know if it's really worth it, because when you get Mike Pence, it might actually be better for them to just wait till 2020 and go for the election.
Right. And I should have been more clear there. I was referencing an opinion poll about Democratic voters.
Oh,
and that was on me. But yeah, so I think we want to look at this story, and I think the most important impact of it, to the extent that it has one, is potentially in getting Cohen involved in the Mueller investigation in a more substantial way. We saw a lot of kind of indications that he was trying to establish essentially a cooperation agreement with Mueller, but that doesn't seem to be reciprocated on the side of the investigation. There was no cooperation clause in his plea deal, which means that he is not actively working with the investigation, as opposed to Manafort, which is the next big story of the day. We'll get into the facts there. Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager from late March to mid-August 2016, was found guilty of 8 counts, 5 of tax fraud, and then a couple of other bank fraud charges related all to his period as a Ukrainian consultant / political operator. And again, this is according to some fantastic Vox reporting. These charges don't relate, again, necessarily to the Russia investigation, because they do stem from the time that he was working with Ukrainian forces, not military, but with Ukrainian politicians. And it's entirely possible that in this case, Mueller is trying to put pressure on Manafort to flip, you know, and to provide information on the alleged dealings of the Trump campaign with Russia. But it's also entirely possible that Mueller does not like it when people break the law, and he wants Manafort to sit in timeout in jail and reflect on his being a naughty, naughty boy, which is something I will never, ever again say on air. Ryan, we're going to go to you again and kind of get your initial thoughts on this. How do you see this, you know, in contrast to the Cohen story?
I think this is less noise, or I think this is more noise than the Cohen story, mm-hmm, because I think that the campaign finance laws are very easy to follow, and
right,
that, and just like breaking a simple law like that with the Stormy Daniels payment is just ridiculous and stupid. While committing tax fraud is just being a jerk, like cheating the system, cheating American people out of their money, or just cheating how the game is supposed to be played. So, I mean, I really don't think this is like a Trump issue. This is just if you want to say, like, he's not hiring the best because they're just not good guys.
Right, sure. And Anurag, we'll go to you, and if you can speak to the kind of broader way that these two stories, I mean, they happen within 4 minutes of each other.
Yeah, it was like a, you know, the end of a season finale or something like
that. Right, yeah, it's just, I mean, a 1-2 punch immediately. So can you speak to the broader kind of narrative that this starts to demonstrate in terms of Trump's criminality and the criminality of those around him?
Well, Manafort was deeply embedded in the campaign, and he was actually, you know, Mike Pence owes a lot to Paul Manafort because Manafort actually selected Mike Pence out of a whole long list of people and got Trump and Pence into a room together, and that basically got Pence into the White House. And Manafort was also, I think, involved in that infamous Trump Tower meeting. I think he was the only non-family member who met with the Maria Butina, who I think is the NRA Russian spy or whatever. And so he was an important part in the campaign in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this just, you know, he's a thug like most of Trump's minions. And so seeing him go to jail for something is, you know, obviously not, I don't cry any tears for that, but right. I don't know if it's going to actually come back to hurt Trump. I mean, if you know that, you know, Michael Cohen pled guilty, Manafort went to trial, and, you know, Trump has been defending Paul Manafort, so it seems like Manafort either has nothing on Trump or is refusing to cooperate with prosecutors. So I don't know how important this is. And I think that the media's obsessive coverage over both Cohen and Manafort, I think, speaks to the fact that they really, really want this Russia investigation, you know, this Russia story to play out.
Right.
And, you know, there were some other developments. I think there was, you know, Alan Weisselberg, who was Trump's CFO since the 1970s, he's been his accountant, basically, getting immunity. David Pecker, the guy who was part of the National Enquirer,
right,
who got the payoff from Michael Cohen, also has immunity. So people are flipping. But like I said, I don't know where this is going to end up, because my bet is that, you know, even Clinton wasn't impeached. Nixon didn't go to prison. He resigned. So, you know, the fantasy of the liberal of, you know, Trump going to jail is, while an interesting fantasy, something that probably won't happen.
Right. Yeah. Matthew, you're a felon, so why don't you why don't you give us your thoughts in terms of how these two stories, because they are so proximate to each other, are really being elided, and if that is potentially something that, you know, shouldn't be going on.
Well, elided?
Elided as in, like, conjoined into one narrative when really they're two separate.
They are two separate narratives. Whereas Cohen, you know, has a dramatic involvement with Trump, the problem is that Manafort, really, it doesn't involve Trump because it was these Ukrainian charges. I mean, it has nothing to do. We have really good reason to believe that Trump had no idea that Manafort was hiding money in the Ukraine.
Right.
I mean, who else hides money in the Ukraine? That's a Switzerland job. But, as you said earlier, the current policy of the Justice Department is not to indict presidents and to wait for impeachment trials. But the problem is, as the impeachment trial is such a political thing, it's really kind of a pulse of the nation thing.
Mm.
You've got to figure out, you know, how much of the country would actually be upset with the situation, if they would trust Manafort, especially considering Manafort didn't come out, didn't plead guilty for so long.
Right.
Whether or not that makes him seem like an unreliable witness to, you know, supporters of Trump, which is definitely going to be a hard base to turn. I mean, the Pulse of the Nation did a survey, I think, about 3 or 4 months ago, and they ask, and this is true, if Donald Trump murdered a journalist for spreading lies, would you still vote for him in 2020? And 29% of people said yes.
Ooh,
so yeah. That's the kind of situation we're up against if you actually would want to pursue to impeachment.
Looks like he was right about shooting someone in the middle of Avenue, right, or whatever he said. But I mean, what is interesting is that, first of all, Paul Manafort, when you think about him going to jail, it's like, it's a big, big, huge deal. He's going to a very comfy jail. And during the trial, when he was in jail without bail, you would think, oh, he's like, he's really having a tough time. He was given a laptop, and he was given a lot of things, and he was a really comfy cell and a lot of room. And so, you know, I think it speaks to, like you were saying, the whole tax fraud is a serious crime, in my opinion, where you're taking money out of the pockets of American taxpayers. Essentially, and you're not doing, you know, what you're supposed to be doing as a citizen. And the fact that we prosecute financial crimes so, you know, flippantly, frankly, Eric Holder, Obama's attorney general, was asked about this, and he was asked, like, why haven't you prosecuted financial crimes, and why don't you prosecute them as heavily as, you know, if someone were to just, you know, rob a bank? And his reaction was very, I think, not deserving of the actual seriousness of these crimes. And, you know, if Paul Manafort, people are worried about Paul Manafort, I think also because if what Paul Manafort did was illegal, probably many people in Washington, D.C. would also go to jail because, you know, tax evasion, stuff like that. I think that a lot of people are liable for that, especially for foreign lobbying and things of that nature.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff like that that goes on in D.C. all the time.
Yeah, well, Anurag is putting on his waders and jumping into the swamp. But I think that goes to a broader point about, you know, the criminality of the individuals around Trump. We saw just recently that the first two Republicans to endorse Trump, Duncan Hunter and Chris Collins, have both found themselves in legal trouble recently. Collins has been arrested by the FBI on charges of insider trading, and Hunter and his wife have been indicted for using $250,000 of campaign funds for personal use. So I think if we're going to, you know, try to blend these narratives together to the extent that they ought to be, it goes to the broader point of contradicting President Trump's or then candidate Trump's message of drain the swamp. You know, he went into the presidency on this idea that he was going to be, you know, a light shining in the darkness, a disinfectant cleaning up DC. But, you know, what we're seeing is that it's kind of these people who have just been, you know, swamp muckers for so long. I mean, Manafort has been operating in DC for several decades, and Hunter and Collins are both you know, pretty mainstream Republicans that are getting tied up. And again, I don't want to, you know, put these stories in direct contrast to each other because they're all substantively different. Hunter and Collins are not as related to the Trump campaign as Manafort or as close to the president himself as Cohen was. But I think it really goes to speak to a way in which all of these stories happening so quickly back to back could begin to chip away at that idea of President Trump as the drain the swamp candidate, which his base really rallied around. So to the extent that this might have an effect, and we'll see if it's reflected in those approval ratings amongst his base trending downwards, that's going to be a polling that we're awaiting. But while we sit on the edge of our seats for that, we are going to talk about Senator John McCain's passing. According to a statement released by his office, Senator John Sidney McCain III died at 4:28 p.m. on August 25th, 2018, after a long struggle against a glioblastoma, or brain cancer. McCain was a veteran and also a prisoner of war for nearly 6 years after being shot down while flying a combat mission over Hanoi, and has been a senator since 1987. So, Anurag, we've been talking in the Texas Orator Slack chat and have actually just recently put up a piece on John McCain. So I want to kind of get your thoughts, because I know that you kind of cut against the grain of eulogizing here.
Yeah, I have many disagreements with that piece that was published in the Texas Orator about, you know, eulogizing John McCain. It's very, there's a lot of, you know, the media is very publishing a lot of hagiographical, you know, pablum, in my opinion, about McCain and, you know, how great he was, how, you know, this is a hero, this is a patriot. And I think, you know, people would say there's this philosophy about, you know, not speaking ill of the dead. But I think when you're a political figure, your record needs to be evaluated as a whole. And it's quite clear that, you know, McCain, in my opinion, was one of the biggest warmongers in the Senate. I mean, he was someone who came back from, you know, learning a lesson from Hanoi, you would think. He was called anti-torture. He actually wasn't. His record was quite spotty on that. And there was a lot of things that, you know, in my opinion, that he was vehemently against Obamacare before he was for it. He's called a maverick. You know, he was called this, you know, maverick of the Republican Party. He voted with Trump like 83% of the time. So I don't know what that makes you a maverick at all. And there were a lot of things that, you know, I really do disagree with him on. And those had serious political consequences. And if you think that politics is just a baseball game and, you know, everyone can just go home, then yeah, I'm sure that you can, you know, if he's nice to journalists and he can speak very nicely, then sure, I'm sure that stylistically he's probably a very nice person. But when you get to the substance, you know, his record needs to be evaluated as a whole. And I think that people, who, you know, especially liberals who are, you know, speaking praises about John McCain,
right,
if this was any other Republican, they would be actually seriously probing this.
Yeah, that's the first thing I thought too. So the last like major, like I would say like conservative death was Scalia.
Yes, exactly.
And I remember like people were basically chanting in the streets about how happy they were that Scalia passed. And Scalia was barely praised, like for a second maybe, and not even like how John McCain was. All of his stuff was just destroyed. Like every single like little Supreme Court decision was spotlighted, just showing how he was a mean guy.
Well, I think even Scalia was given a lot of, you know, a lot of benefit because Scalia was considered, you know, he was eulogized by the Washington Post as this beacon of judicial conservatism and, you know, this fiery wit and stuff like that. When in fact, I mean, Scalia's record was very not judicially conservative when it suited the Republican agenda. So it just so happened that, you know, his reading of the Constitution happened to go with the Republican Party every single time, which seems to suggest that maybe he's a bit more partisan than he carries on. But that's Scalia. And the same with McCain. I mean, McCain, he voted for the Iraq War. I mean, it's quite unclear under McCain's worldview which country he wouldn't want to go to war with, because he wanted to go to war with Iran since the 1990s. He wanted to go to war with North Korea. He wanted to go to war with Syria and Ukraine and Russia and all these places. And it's like, I mean, you would think that Eisenhower's quote is, you know, a soldier knows the consequences of war, but apparently not so with John McCain.
Right. Yeah. So Matthew, I want you to throw some hagiographical pablum at us here about John McCain, if you have it.
Yeah. I noticed you just typed the word hagiographical pablum on the screen, but I don't actually know what that means.
Well, it's something happens to be the name of our new band for the Texas Order. But if you've got any kind words to say about Senator or former Senator John McCain, now is the time to get them out there, because I guarantee you they're not coming from me.
Okay, all right. All you kids out there, apparently hagiographical means writing about the lives of saints. That's good to know. I'm not going to say he was a perfect man. I'm definitely not going to say that. I mean, no senator is, unfortunately. But he was much better than a lot of the Republicans, actually a lot of the congressmen we're having to deal with today, especially when you consider, you know, even like, you know, the Iraq War, that was obviously a mistake. But it seemed, you know, what we know of the 2003 Congress was that they were working off of information that the administration had falsely given them, right? So that's not entirely his fault. And he's had a lot of he's done a lot of good things. So this is partly Longhorns for Voting Reform, me here talking here. But ever since the Keating Five back in 1980, when he accidentally supported, or maybe purposely supported, still unclear, Keating's bank fraud, ever since then, he's been really high on changing campaign finance laws, which is not something a lot of politicians like to do. It's kind of a third rail for most people, you know, to talk about political finance, because it's, you know, political finance that they and their associates are benefiting from.
Well, I mean, that was the McCain before pre-2008. And pre-2008, you know, during the 2000 election, he talked about campaign finance and had worked bipartisan, as a bipartisan measure to try to reform campaign finance. But, you know, after 2008, when he lost to Obama, after a very scurrilous campaign where he really, you know, people say that Trump's campaign against Clinton was quite bad. You see what McCain was doing at the time when Barack Obama was running. I mean, you had people in his crowds chanting "terrorist," you know, cut off his head and things of that nature. We slam Trump for doing that now, for in the locker up, but that, people were doing that in 2008. And of course, you know, the palinification of the GOP and things of that nature. And then post 2008, when he, you know, lost it to Obama, he flipped on almost all these issues. Like, for example, for campaign finance, he went lock in step with the GOP and tried to repeal Obamacare, you know, for the famous thumbs down that he gave. He'd wanted to repeal Obamacare for the longest time, and the reason he gave the thumbs down was because he wasn't sure that the entire law would be repealed. He then voted for the tax plan, which basically shanked Obamacare. And so, you know, I think the liberal reading of McCain as this person, you know, this principled guy who is so, like, who bucked the party on so many issues, is really not reality. And it speaks to the, like, how I think there was a quote from The Atlantic about how the media really doesn't have a partisan bias, but it has a bias to stories. This, you know, the story of this guy who was tortured as a POW, which is obviously terrible, and then coming into Congress and fighting against, you know, this old man fighting against this boisterous, bombastic Trump. That's a good story. And so people can, you know, talk about that and, you know, eulogize McCain and things of that nature. But it's not, you know, that's not news. That's not the actual truth. And I think that's the problem. And that's probably why Trump also rose to power, because the news thought, Trump, this is a good story here.
Right. Yeah. And I think, to finally give my thoughts here, when we're talking about public figures, especially politicians who step into the realm of policy, that's exactly what they're doing. They are, you know, it's an elective position. It's an elected and an elective position. You are going voluntarily. You're putting yourself into that position. And so I think when we see this kind of, as Honorable was saying, this hagiography around them following their passing, you know, I think the thing to do is to make the, you know, Sybil statement. It is awful that he has died.
Yes, of course.
You know, everyone here is doing those, and I think it's you know, I feel for his family, and my thoughts are with them. But when you look at the you know, policy positions that he's had, I think a lot of the things that we see is that he was exactly a stylistic guy. It was someone who was infamous or, you know, notorious for the way that he talked, not the things that he said. You know, I think one of the perfect examples of that is an interview he was giving back in 2008 where a reporter asked him, essentially, how are we going to fix this healthcare situation? And he just kind of spoke off the cuff about, oh, we've got this financial plan where we're going to have, you know, a tax system that then redistributes and subsidizes essentially the quasi-Medicare system. And then he went to his economics guy, you know, the economic advisor to his campaign, was like, all right, how's this going to work? And the guy's like, I don't know. I literally just found out about this from what you said in the interview. You know, he was not a substantive policy guy in many respects. And even on the things that I think one would expect him to really be strong on in terms of being anti-war and being skeptical of the notion of looking for monsters abroad, we did not see that coming from him. And from a kind of libertarian point of view, I really don't think that there is a whole lot to commend him on campaign finance. I think he was awful. I disagree with Matthew respectively for why that was, but I think, you know, what we saw is that in terms of the hagiography around McCain, it was, and there's going to be a running competition on how many times I can say that word on air, the praise that we saw for him was really for the way that he was not, you know, it's for that maverick idea, which, you know, as we look at his voting record, was not really something that I think was borne out. He voted as a Republican a vast majority of the time, and when we saw him vote against the Republican Party, it was in a, you know, a flare and flashy style, and was obviously meant to garner that kind of notoriety or that kind of stylistic choice or stylistic narrative about him. And so, you know, again, when you step into the ring as a public elected official, you are stepping into the ring of policy. And that is what you are going to be or should be remembered and commended for, or, you know, forgotten and detracted for. So I really don't think that when we look at McCain's policy record, there's a whole lot to commend him from in terms of my kind of libertarian classical liberal ideas. I know Anurag is not especially commendatory of him from his perspective. Matthew, you've been kind of sitting on the edge of your seat here. Go ahead.
Well, it's the thing that it's not just supporting what he actually did, but kind of supporting what he stood for, which sounds kind of like kind of a bit of a cop-out, but it is an important thing to think about.
Right.
You know, if you can support a candidate that at least appears bipartisan, it makes it more popular abroad.
Right.
Whether or not he always was, or whether or not he stood there is important, but not so important when it comes to how the electorate will act in his absence.
Mm.
I mean, he's possibly, at the time, the most powerful Republican who still supported fixing climate change. Not, you know, very aggressively, but it was still part of his policy.
I mean, you say that, you know, we have to think about what he stood for, and then I guess what I would say to that is, well, clearly what he stood for was America is going to be waging war all across the whole world. I mean, I think that he is partly, and this goes to, you know, I think this was raised in the Slack chat about how culpable is someone in the Senate, especially, who holds that much power, one of the most powerful people in the world, by the way. How much culpability do you have for American interventionism abroad? How much blood, so to speak, is on your hands from the, you know, thousands of Iraqis, Yemenis, Libyans, and so on that McCain supported the interventions of? And McCain was, you know, he wasn't just a run-of-the-mill senator who just voted for the Iraq War and then later regretted it. I mean, this guy has been, for the longest time, and he has also courted some really, really bad characters. He met with, you know, a neo-Nazi group that was trying to fight Putin in the Ukraine, and has been courting a lot of people that, like, solely because it goes towards the idea of American interventionism. And so I think, like you were saying, you're a political figure. Obviously, what happened to him is a tragedy. And, being tortured also is a horrible thing. And I wouldn't wish that upon anyone. And then this whole brain cancer situation. But when you are a political figure, you need to be judged on your merits as a political figure, because your actions have consequences. Mm-hmm. And so, and McCain thought, and I just wanted to point out, by the way, that McCain believed that his real base was, and he talked about it, like his true base is that of the reporters that covered him. And that really shows. I mean, there is almost universal, like, acclaim for McCain over the ostensibly liberal networks. I mean, there was so much coverage given to the White House flying the staff, flag at half mast. There's a number of important news stories that were not covered that should be covered, like the whole, there was recently a prison strike. There was, the Trump administration recently announced their plan to replace the Clean Power Act, which is likely to raise emissions. These are all serious stories. Instead, they're focusing on this made-up story about, this flag was flying at half-mast, and, like, what does that mean? What does it stand for? It's just complete, like, reality TV. Like,
it's a happy story.
Yeah.
It's very obvious, like, who's good, who's bad. It's very easy for CNN or MSNBC to say, oh, this guy was a good guy, and then this other guy is being a bad guy right now. I think that's a lot easier for Americans to see. And the whole idea, like the whole preface of when anyone ever talks about McCain is the classic, like, well, I didn't agree with all of his policy, yeah. Which you see everywhere, every single comment, every single Facebook post, you see it like that. And it's very frustrating to look at all the time. And I really try not to focus on like the media. I feel like that's like an almost an old person term, like an angry old person about the news. Like,
well, I use
media.
It a lot, so
no, I get it. It's like, I mean, it's how you describe it right now. But when you want to like look at John McCain, I feel like it's almost not necessary to judge his policy right now. I think he was a very soft Republican and he paved the way for someone like Trump to get in office. But assessing his policy right now, I feel like you can praise him, and it's pretty harmless.
When is the appropriate time to start talking about what they actually did in office? I mean, that to me, yeah. Like when Margaret Thatcher died, and even when Antonin Scalia died and Reagan died, I mean, all
yeah.
these people are, at least when they were alive, they were seriously, McCain was, had this dubious distinction of not really being attacked when he was, but from the left when he was alive. But all these other characters, they were really vehemently disliked for legitimate reasons, not for, smears or whatever. And so when is the appropriate time to start talking about someone's, I mean, he's not just like this grandpa or like someone's uncle, he's someone who has a lot of political power and use that political power to do a lot of, in my opinion, very bad things. And so, and I wouldn't bring this up if, the media, if people weren't talking about, he's a patriot and a war hero and all these things. I mean, you need to judge his character, his record on a lot of different things. And, even you may not disagree. I mean, I think the disagreements I had with him were very strong. And that's the reason that I voice my opposition.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think those are all really kind of the things that I would second, the idea of there is no wrong time to talk about somebody's policy positions. But I don't think that this is something in which you use it as a stepping stone. You take the specific policy positions that you disagree with, you say why, and you move on and talk about them in broader scopes outside of the, you don't say I disagree with them, John McCain is awful because he disagreed with me. You say I disagree with John McCain, and we put that to rest. It's something that for living politicians, that is something you say. I disagree with him. I do not think he is a good politician because XYZ disagreements. And so as we move forward, I think the thing to do is to refocus on those broader policy positions, which is exactly what we are going to do after we come back from this small break. I want you to let you know that you are listening to KVRX on 97.1 FM. Now is the time when a band is supposed to get on and tell you about all the fantastic things that KVRX does, but we're not going to do that because last time I spoke to you, I let you know about a band that I just recently found and actually roomed with for a couple weeks, Spin the Room. They were on KVRX's Student Live show, and I am am entirely positive that they would want you to listen to KVRX. So again, that is Spin the Room. That is two high school friends of mine that have gone off and started their band. They are, one of them at least, is a UT student. And yeah, you should give them a listen when their EP drops in the future.
Did they give you a campaign contribution, Wes?
Is that what you're... We're not going to talk about that.
Is this kind of a call to action?
Right, because that was done through a home equity line that I applied for. And then finally, I want to let you know about a very special specialty show here on KVRX, and that is Not Fake News. Thursdays, 5 p.m. That is my specialty show promo. I'm sticking with it. You can't dissuade me otherwise. So we are back. I am your host, Wes Dotson. This is Declarations from Independence here on KVRX. It is 6:43 a.m. here in Austin, Texas. I am barely awake, but very, very, very much so awoke. cringes all around. So we're going to get into the next big story for UT. And this is the new chancellor. I know that we've discussed him on air previously, but in light of a disagreement that I found out about this morning with one of our lovely hosts here, I want to get into how McRaven did as chancellor and how we expect Milliken to differ as chancellor. So why don't we get Matthew your initial thoughts on McRaven, and I'll respond.
Well, I think McRaven did pretty well. The thing is, there were some mistakes and missteps. The Houston expansion does come to mind. He personally very publicly said that he should have talked with the Houston lawmakers before doing that, right? But there were a lot of successes to come from the situation. A lot of it will, you know, come out later, whether it was good or not, because it had to do with analyses and studies like the teacher education study or the dual credit study. Those things are still ongoing. Well, we're going to have to wait and see how those turned out. But among a lot of the initiatives he put forward, we've seen a lot of turnaround. We've seen a lot of improvement. He, put forward, I think it's called the class, like CLASE study, which was looking into sexual assault on campus.
Right.
The campus is, the university's made a very big turn to try to make sure that these kind of things don't happen as often as they used to the very least. And we've got a lot of good things out of this current chancellor, especially the team of team system. Right. The thing, and I'm sorry, I know you're going to, which is the part of the byline you put here, is that, he came from a very hierarchical, command structure from the military. But the thing is, he didn't come from the military. He came from the SEAL teams, which is slightly different, as opposed to, a chain of command. My lieutenant reports to his captain and above. With the special operations groups, you always have, it's called the team of team system, as championed by General McChrystal, where the teams are working in very close coalition. Their leaders are making sure that the teams know what their thought process is, and people can talk up to the people above them. It's a very Kaizen, Lean Six Sigma way of approaching organization,
right.
And I think it's done wonders for the university to be able to organize itself like this. Were there definitely missteps, once again the Houston expansion? Yes, and I, am not going to argue the fact that he definitely did increase his spending a lot more. I really think he was expecting a lot more of a all guns on deck kind of thing when it came to education in the state of Texas. But I think he did very well considering the circumstances.
Well, so to respond to that last bit about the all guns on deck, I think that's entirely what I mean when I talk about the difference in organizational structure that McRaven fell victim to. And so this idea that when he comes from the JSOC, which is Joint Special Operations Command, he is able to move effectively up and down the tower. And to think about a tower hierarchical structure, it's one that people at the top can control all the way down the system, can very minutely manage things at the bottom, as well as make broad overarching decisions at the top. And so what we saw, McRaven doing in the JSOC is, with the Osama bin Laden raid, it was able to plan it down to the minute details required for the raid. People who can think back to it, when that helicopter went down carrying the second team of SEALs, or not the second team, but a group of SEALs, the backup plan that they initiated was, in fact, a plan that McRaven by and large coordinated. And so when we see somebody who's used to being able to move all the way up and down the structure, coming into a network system, which we think of as much more of a square, something wherein there are different parties all with different motivations and incentives, you know, being able to coordinate them, as you said, in that all guns on deck or all hands on deck manner towards a common goal, I think was something that McRaven expected but was really frustrated by. We saw that with the Houston expansion, of course. I think he did not understand that the University of Texas system is one of many public institution systems, and we saw him running against the legislatures and or the legislators in Houston not even giving them prior notice, as you said, which he mentioned and has expressed that was a misstep. But I think it all stems from that idea of everybody should be and is expected to be moving in the same direction on these issues. And we saw that as well in the administrative spending increases. You know, we went from about mid-$50 million spending to the next year having about $120 to $130 million spending on administrative office positions. And that, I think, can really be seen through the lens of trying to have people who are directly responsive to his command structure system and be able to move quickly and unilaterally across the UT system. And so when I talk about being victim to a structure, I think we saw him trying to change the structure, but also really, you know, falling victim to the network system in terms of the way he interacted with the legislatures, the way he interacted with even the Board of Regents. He came in on this idea of the nine quantum leap, something that was going to be done efficiently, effectively, and in many ways unilaterally, which is what we saw with him working at the top. You know, when we speak about these big overarching goals, I think we tend to lose that idea of, you know, he actually doesn't really have the power in a UT system to make those moves. And Anurag, I can see that you are just raring to go here. So why don't you get your thoughts?
Well, I mean, that's a very charitable view of the take on Bill McRaven. I mean, I was never a big fan of McRaven. Mm-hmm. I mean, his military career, I have disagreements with his military career, you know, many of the things that he did in the military, but I don't really know how that qualifies you to run a UT system, and I think no one really talks about that. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous that someone who is in the military, by the way, people talk about the military and, like, you were talking about the structure, the military structure versus the university structure. I mean, the military is not somewhere you go if you want to be fiscally responsible, I think, and most people realize that, you know. There's plenty of waste there that I think needs to be cut. And you know, you see that trend coming here. When McRaven came here, he rapidly increased administrative spending, spent it on, you know, that Houston project. There was also that online institute that never actually materialized into anything.
Right.
And, you know, he built this fancy new building for the administration. You know, these are not priorities for the students. And, you know, I would think that... you know, for me, I think what needs to happen with regard to public universities is a lot more democracy. And I think that there are a lot of anti-democratic measures that, you know, there's no sort of student... In other countries, you have student boards that have... Or students sit on the board and they are able to...
Student unions as in Canada.
Yes, and they're able to influence policy. You have voters able to, like, actually elect people. Whereas people like to say that there's not royalty in the U.S., but, you know, these people are appointed, and there's the whole appointment process is also full. I'm sure it's full of corruption, and, you know, backroom deals. And so it's just to me, I don't see, if we're talking about public education, we should think that the money should be spent helping students, you know, get into helping people get into the universities and helping them do well. You know, UT is particularly poised to do this because they have billions and billions of dollars in this oil fund that they never they take out money from that all the time, but they don't use it for the students. They use it to enrich themselves and, you know, on these ridiculous new projects because they think that they're like God or the president or
right.
able to create like the future of the world or whatever, the future of, you know, education in the 21st century or whatever. I mean, just stick to what you're supposed to be doing is my advice.
Right. Well, we're saving the best for last. We actually have a member of the American royalty here from the Senate Council of College Councils. There we go. My bad. So, Ryan, you interact with the administration a bit more than I think we probably do,
yes.
to say the least. So why don't you give your thoughts on kind of our takes about McRaven and perhaps some of what we're missing when it comes to the administration.
So I would say the administration is very focused on pleasing the faculty and pleasing the other administration in the school system. So when you have a kind of hierarchy of people at the university. You have students at the very bottom. You have faculty who are leaps and bounds above us, who basically get to do almost whatever they want. Like, we say administration gets to do what they want. Faculty also have this like supreme authority over like what they do. And then above them, you have administration. And administration's goal is to keep faculty and get new faculty. So UT is like a premier educational institution, and we're constantly trying to acquire new faculty. And how do we do that? With money, with grants. So every time a new science professor comes in, we have to spend about $2 million on a lab, and we have to get them set up. We have to get them having the ability to do their research to make UT, again, a top research institution. So I would say while the administration should be doing things directly for the students, oftentimes they're doing the best they can, and it's indirect. The relationship between the administration and us is connected through faculty. So if we want good things to happen that are beneficial to us, the administration might not always be doing things that appear to be good for us solely.
Yeah, I mean, to respond to that briefly,
They know what's best for us, right?
Well, yeah. So I my vision of a good kind of collegiate environment is students sitting around a chalkboard with a professor who's getting paid more than anybody ever should be to be there, because he or she or they are fantastic professors. And I think that's exactly right to think about that as the end goal of the administration. But when we see a lot of the spending that has been going on in terms of While faculty spending, and this is a broader national trend, certainly exemplified at UT under McRaven's reign, but a broader national trend nonetheless, what we're seeing is administrative spending is increasing, far outpaces the amount that's being spent on faculty increases. And I don't have the specific numbers here. I should have come in prepared with that, but I think when we're looking at that, what we're seeing is a lot of the administrative burden comes from these things, that these new initiatives, a lot of the ideas that McRaven had was about expanding the amount of, you know, opportunities for UT students in terms of degrees, in terms of programs. But what we're seeing is that doesn't tend to actually be the driver of, you know, either growth or job placement, because the real focus should be on graduating. The power of a degree is entirely the power of, you sat at a desk for 4 years, we know you can sit there and learn things quickly, efficiently, and we can teach them to you, and you're going to learn 90% of what you need to know on the job, unless you are a hard skill major like those electrical engineering, like that computer science, wherein they do teach a lot of those hard skills. But for many UT students, and for, I think we can say most UT students, what the power of a degree is the knowledge that the employer has, that you can sit at a desk and, you know, essentially learn and be told things. You can manage a bureaucracy, and they can kind of instill in you the knowledge that they need you to do, and you will do it day in, day out.
Well, I mean, that's more of a, like, a technical kind of universe. I mean, I would think that also a part of a college degree is getting a, like, an education and, like, being a learned person. not just, you know, going to, like, you know, being able to tell, like, manager, like, tell what exactly you have to do, and, like, being able to go into the workforce, because, I mean, there are, you know, vocational schools for that.
So, to respond to that, I think a lot of what we want to look at there is the long-term outlook of those. You know, what we see is that for people who don't use the knowledge that they acquire in those kind of non-technical classes, so to think about a lot of the humanities majors, to think about a lot of the undergraduate requirements for even technical majors, what we see is that if they don't use that day in, day out in their work, they lose a lot of that knowledge. So I think the point that I would take there from that is the idea of learning how to learn. And I think that's a fair point to make for a lot of those
It's classes. It's a cliche college statement, but it's definitely true.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got some merit, the idea of, you know, being able to deal with difficult conceptual level problems in those classes is something that I think is certainly valuable. But in terms of the actual, like, becoming a wine drinking campus, you know, reader, I'm pretty skeptical of the role that college plays, and that I think a lot of what we see there is kind of selection bias. The people there that are going to be disposed to that kind of mode of life are disposed to it, you know, either by nature or by nurture.
I mean, we came in being wine drinking cannabis
right,
readers.
Right, of course, so. Yeah. Of course, we were talking about grape juice drinking cannabis readers. And that, I think, is going to do it for us today. This has been Declarations from Independence. I am your host, Wes Dodson. Stick around for the next show coming up, and I will see you back here at 6 a.m. next Tuesday. Tune in, or you should tune in. I can't tell you to tune in.
If you want.
You can tune in. It would make me happy if you tuned in to Not Fake News with Anurag Singh at
5 p.m. Thursday.
Thursdays, 5 p.m.